Sefer Devarim opens up at the very end of the 40 years in the Midbar, in almost the last remaining time that Moshe Rabbeinu has as the manhig, as the leader of the Jewish nation, close to the end of his life, and begins there a long litany of complaints. Rashi explains to us that at this point, because Moshe Rabbeinu saw that it was close to the end of his life, it was time for him to give tochacha, to give musar, to give rebuke, to criticize the Jewish nation. And Rashi explains, why is it that Moshe Rabbeinu waited till almost the last opportunity, till almost the very end of his life? Explains Rashi that he learned from Yaakov Avinu. Just like Yaakov Avinu didn't give tochacha, didn't give musar, didn't criticize his children until close to his death. And then Rashi explains what the Midrash says. Yaakov Avinu called in Reuven and said to him, my son, I'm going to explain to you why I didn't give you musar all of these years. I was afraid to do it. Why? Because shalot tanichini, so that you wouldn't leave me, v'telech v'tidbak be'esev achi, so that you shouldn't leave me and cling to Esav. The reason why Yaakov Avinu didn't give musar to Reuven all of those years until it was Es Lassos, until it was the last moments of his life, until he had no other choice, was because he said to Reuven, I was afraid that had I given you musar, had I rebuked you, you would have left my ways, you would have gone to Esav, and therefore I didn't do it. But now this is the last opportunity I have. That's why at the very end of his life, Yaakov Avinu gave musar to his children. That's why he told Reuven at the end of his life. Moshe Rabbeinu learned from that, and he too only rebuked the Klal Yisrael at the very end of his life. And this Rashi would be interesting, would teach us some powerful lessons, if it weren't for the obvious question. And that question is, how is it possible that Yaakov Avinu thought that Reuven would leave his ways and be dovek, cling to Esav? The person we're dealing with is one of the Shiftei Ka, one of the 12 Shvatim, one of the greatest, certainly, people of his generation, one of the greatest people who ever lived. All of the Shvatim were tzaddikim. They were holy, pure Jews. Reuven was a man of stature. Reuven was a man who had reached such heights. And this was his Rebbe. Yaakov Avinu was the father of Reuven. Yaakov Avinu was the mentor of Reuven. Yaakov Avinu was the beloved teacher of Reuven. And yet Rashi's telling us that Yaakov was afraid that had I given him tochacha, had I rebuked him, he would have left my ways and gone to Esav. He would have become, I don't know, he would have left the derech, gone off the derech. It sounds very difficult to understand. And it sounds even more difficult to understand if we focus on what was the grave sin that Reuven did. So Rashi explains to us that what Reuven did was he overstepped his bounds. Rachel died. And when Rachel died, Yaakov moved his main domicile, his main tent, from Rachel to Bilhah. Meaning Yaakov Avinu had four wives, and he would visit them when he did, but the main place where he lived, his main tent, was by Rachel. When Rachel died, Yaakov made his main place where he lived was by Bilhah. And Reuven felt that that was an affront to the honor of his mother. Explains Rashi that Reuven said, listen, Rachel, my mother, we're equals. But if you're going to move the tent from Rachel Imenu to one of the shivchas, to one of the maidservants, what an insult to my mother. To put her, to equate her on the level of my mother, Reuven felt that it was an affront to the honor of his mother, and therefore, explains Rashi, and almost all the Rishonim explain it this way, that Reuven went into the tent of Bilhah, and he moved around the furniture as a sign of protest. What he was doing was protesting the honor of his mother. Now, it happens to be that for him to mix into the affairs of his father, for him to protest what Yaakov Avinu did was inappropriate. He overstepped his bounds. And to give us an illustration of how far the Torah considers it a impropriety, let me give you a mashal. It's almost like, he violated the Pilegish. But the Rishonim explained to us he didn't touch Bilhah. There was no violation in any sense. It's a mushal, it's a dimion to explain to us, for Reuven to enter into the affairs of his father is such an affront to the dignity of his father that it's as if he lived with Bilhah. The point is, his sin was not a grave, serious sin. And even if it was, and even if you'll tell me that for a man in his stature, the Torah considers it that serious, and it is a real issue, what are the odds that this man is going to leave Yaakov and be dovek to Esav, go cling to Esav? This is his Rebbe. They have the closest, most powerful bond imaginable. Yaakov Avinu is the most sensitive, loving, kindly father. Reuven clings to his father and his Rebbe as his link to Sinai, his attachment to everything great and proper. He learns from his father. He follows his father's ways. And Yaakov is afraid that if I give him tocha, if I rebuke him, he's going to leave. He'll not only just, when he take it well, he'll leave my ways and go to Esav. It sounds very, very difficult to understand. And I'd like to see if we could better understand exactly what this Rashi is sharing with us and see what Chazal are teaching us about human nature. And to do that, I'd like to share with you an interesting story. In the 1930s, there lived a notorious gangster. And this man was considered one of the most heinous, most evil people. His name was Two Gun Crowley. He was also known as Two Gun Crowley, the cop killer. And he was known throughout the streets of New York. The police commission at the time described him as one of the most ruthless, hardened killers. He would kill at the drop of a feather. In any case, Two Gun Crowley actually fired his last bullet in a shootout with police when he was in an apartment on West Avenue. Now, you have to appreciate the drama here. His apartment was surrounded by 150 policemen who used everything they had in their power. They used tear gas. There were machine guns mounted on different rooftops surrounding it. And for over an hour, Two Gun Crowley held the New York City Police Department at bay while 10,000 people watched from the street below. There was a shootout on the west side. In the end, in fact, he was shot, and the police broke into his apartment, and they found that before he was shot, he wrote his last will and testament. He wrote a message, and this is what the words said. On a sheet of paper, drenched in his blood, were written the words, "To whom it may concern. Under my coat lies a lonely heart, but a good heart, a heart that would do no man harm." And he signed it. Now, I want you to appreciate who this man was. The way he ended up in that apartment, in that shootout, was because a few hours earlier, he was in Central Park, sitting in a car with his girlfriend. A police officer came by and asked him for his license and registration. He could have easily driven off. This is the 1930s. There are no radios, there's no email, he would have driven off and been gone. But why take any chances? He reaches in to seemingly pull out his wallet. Instead, he pulls out a gun and he empties his pistol into the policeman's body. He jumps out of the car and pulls out the service revolver from the policeman and empties that into the lying there prone policeman. Two Gun Crowley jumps back into his car and races back to his West Side apartment, and eventually he was caught in the shootout. A kind heart, a heart that would do no man any harm. But our story doesn't end there. Two Gun Crowley managed to live through the shootout. Yes, he was shot, and he was unconscious when the police broke in, but he actually survived. They took him to the hospital, and they operated on him. He survived, and he stood trial for many of his crimes. In the end, he was sentenced to death. On the way to the electric chair, he was overheard saying these words, "This is what I get for defending myself." Now, you may think of this story as illustrative of a person with psychiatric issues, a person who's delusional, a person who's out of touch with reality, but this phenomena seems to be a component of every human being. We human beings don't do things that are wrong. Everyone who's ever involved in anything, from the greatest crime to the most minor misdeed, has a rationale, has a reason. As a matter of fact, Dale Carnegie, in his book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, explains that he had an ongoing correspondence with the warden of Sing Sing. Sing Sing prison back in those days was the most, it was for the most hardened criminals. These were the real terrors of society. And the commissioner, the warden, explained clearly that every one of the prisoners in Sing Sing was not guilty. Everyone had a reason, a rationale, why he had to do it, why he was innocent, why he was a victim. And this seems to be a phenomena that cuts across every human being. I never do anything wrong. And no matter how grave the sin or how minor, I'm innocent, I'm a victim, and I never do anything wrong. Now, I had a chance to see this phenomena in a much more localized way, in a much smaller way, but to me it was very eye-opening. I was a Rebbe for many years. I was in out-of-town yeshiva. She was in Rochester. And you have to appreciate, like any yeshiva, they're very fine fellows coming from good homes. And every once in a while, there are issues that happen. In any case, there were a string of genevas in the dorm. Somebody was stealing money. Someone was stealing on a regular basis. And it became a major issue. They couldn't find the person. They tried different things. In the end, they ended up catching the fellow who was involved. And he admitted to all the entire string of these robberies of stealing the money. And the thing that shocked me was he was a fellow in my shir, but worse than that, he was a popular guy, a regular good guy, not some kind of misfit, not some kind of, dejected loser, a regular guy who had a lot of friends and is very popular. And to me, it didn't make sense. And at a certain point, I sat him down and we were talking about what happened. And I was talking to him. In the course of a conversation, it came out that he had no charata, no regret. And he said to me these words. He said, Rabbi, you have to understand, everybody needs money. Some guys get money from their parents. Some guys have jobs. This is how I make money. This is how I make money. And in his mind, it wasn't thievery. It wasn't stealing. This is how he made a living. Everybody needs money. This is how he does it. His own friends, his own classmates. And this phenomenon you will find every day of the week in almost every segment of society, that I never do anything wrong. And I'd like to explain to you why that is. You see, when Hashem created the human, if it could be, there was a problem. The neshama, that means the conscious part of I, the one who thinks, the one who feels, I, the one inside, were taken from under the Kisei HaKavod. I am a brilliant, insightful, pure neshama. But the goal of creation was to give man bechira, free will. So to allow for free will, Hashem put me into this body, and now within this body there are all types of desires and interests, and the I, who am now conscious, have two different dimensions to me. There's a part of me that's noble and great and proper, and there's a part of me that's created with pure-based desires, appetites, and hunger. My pure neshama only wants to do what's proper, only wants to serve Hashem, only wants to learn, only wants to be generous and helpful. And there's another part of me that completely, totally couldn't care about anything but my own interests. And I am an absolute contradiction. I'm a living, walking stira, two parts of me, each one demanding its fill. The fight of life is which one is dominant, which one comes to the fore, which one takes control. In everything that we do throughout life, one or the other becomes more primary and becomes more powerful. And that is one of the great dilemmas of creation. You see, how could you take in a neshama that's so insightful, brilliant, and good, put it into a body and actually give it free will? You see, here's the problem. I would never do something that damages me. For instance, if I were to ask you, do you have free will to put your hand into a fire? Your free will. Let's say I were to pull out a $100 bill and say, this $100 bill is yours if you put your hand into a fire for 1 minute. Now, in theory, you could do it. You could put your hand there, but you never would because it's foolish. You would never do something that damages you because it's utterly stupid. even if you wanted the $100, even if it was $1,000, you wouldn't do it because it's self-inflicted damage. And as tempting as it might be, you just never would actually do it. And you see, that's one of the great dilemmas of creation. Because granted, Hashem put us, me, the pure seichel, pure intellect, into this body. And granted, within this body, there are desires and interests that don't serve me any good or mankind any good. It doesn't bring me closer to Hashem or more perfect. But how could I ever choose to listen to that other voice when I clearly understand that it's wrong, improper, will damage me, and is something I'll regret? Meaning, let's in fact say I have a desire for whatever it may be. I know it's wrong, and I know it's improper. But more than that, I know it's damaging to me. It's not going to make me happier, not going to make me more fulfilled, and it's something that for eternity I'll regret. So how could you take an neshama that's brilliant and insightful, put it into a body, give it desires, it'll never give in. Why? Because it knows that it's damaging. It'll never give in to the desire, much like I wouldn't put my hand in a fire for $100 or $1,000 because it's self-inflicted damage. Every mitzvah helps me grow. Every avera damages me. And the human being should never have actual free will. In theory, he or she could choose to do what's wrong, but the human being never would. And to allow for practical free will, Hashem created something called imagination. Imagination is this fanciful ability to live in a different world, to feel things as if they really, really happened. If you read a novel about a pirate living 300 years ago, and it's well written, it's not he that's on the deck of the ship swashbuckling, fighting off the other sailors. It's you. And imagination is a powerful force that Hashem put into us that allows us to create our reality and allows us to feel it, at least on some level, as if it's real. And one of the functions of imagination is to allow for actual, practical free will. Why? Because watch what happens. Within me, there is a voice of reason. Within me, there's a voice that cries out, do what's right, what's proper, serve Hashem, help other people, feel the pain. The neshama is imprinted with all of the instincts to do everything noble and great. And within me is a voice that says, I don't care about anybody but me, my desires, my appetites, my needs. And any time I have a confrontation between the two voices, there's also a mitigating factor. You see, I want to do this, but I don't want to do that. And I want to do what's right and proper, but there's another voice that says, come on, take care of you. You want, you need. And to allow for practical free will, Hashem allows us to have this force of imagination that creates an entire delusional world via which whatever I want to be true, I can feel as if it's true, I accept it, I believe it. And if you'd like to know why it is that no one ever does anything wrong, it's because it's the only way there could be free will. The neshama is so pure and holy that it can never allow the I to do anything wrong. And to allow me to do something that's incorrect, that's improper, I have to have this ability to accept that that which I want to do is good, right, and proper. And the reason why no one ever does anything that's wrong is because it's one of the greatest defense mechanisms, one of the greatest abilities to allow the neshama, which is so pure and holy, to actually have free will, because now, in fact, I accept that that which I want to do isn't bad, isn't evil, isn't damaging, it's good, right, and proper. And if you'd like to see a classic example of this, open up Mein Kampf. Hitler wrote an 800-page treatise, not explaining why he wants the Jews dead, explaining why it's a service to humanity, why it's a goodness, and how he's serving his creator and helping out mankind by eliminating this scourge, this parasite. As one kills a vermin and doesn't worry about it, so too one has to rid the world of the Jews. And if you listen to the Nazi ideology, they didn't say, yeah, it's wrong and bad to kill, but come on, let's do it anyway. It's fun. what they screamed in very powerful, clear terms was, it's good, it's right, and it's proper. And the reason Hashem gave us this force of imagination, this ability to believe whatever I want to believe, is because now man has actual free will. Now, if I want to do something, there's no voice inside that says, how could you do that? You're a louse. You're a creep. How could you act that way? What do you mean a louse and a creep? It's right. It's good. It's proper. I mean, it's not stealing. It's not going to give us how people make money. A Tugun Kroli could believe in his heart that he's servicing mankind, that he's a good man. Nebuchadnezzar has to defend himself. This is what he has to do. And every criminal in Sing Sing believes it. And every human being who ever lived on this planet accepts the fact that what I do is good, right, and proper. And this is a component of the human being. It's a deep understanding that allows us to understand how Hashem gave Bechira. And it also is something that has a very powerful manifestation. One of the best secular books ever written is Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. As a high school rebbe, I used to tell the guys regularly, you should read it, study it, study it. I didn't have the courage to really speak about it publicly until I saw that Rabbi Miller in his Sefer writes that it's a tremendously necessary book. After reading how in favor he was of it, I bought the original edition. I think it was published in 1936. It was even better than the current one. But this is a book that should be taught in every school, in every business, in every home. It will greatly influence the way that you and others act, because it's a book about people skills, basic understandings of the human, and it is an incredibly important and effective tool to being a better, more effective person. And in this book, he has his first rule. The first primary rule in all human relations, says Dale Carnegie, is don't criticize. Don't do it. And he brings classic example after example after example. And I'd like to explain to you why you shouldn't criticize. The Or HaTzaddikim explains that, let's imagine for a minute that I'm walking down the street and you jump on me. You start punching me. I'm punching and kicking. It's instinctive. It's just basic to any human to fight back. It's just expected. It's normal. If you punch me, of course I punch back. When a human being criticizes another human being, it's like a punch. You see, there's a greatness within me. Within me is a godless Adam, a sense of greatness. And I know I was put on this planet to accomplish, to do great things. And I like feeling good about myself. And anything that I do wrong, I defend with an image of it's good, it's right, and proper. And along come you, point the finger at me, and say the words, you messed up, you failed, you are guilty. I am not. What do you mean? I? Me? Do you know who I am? Do you know? And much like if you were to punch me, obviously I'm going to punch back. It's natural. It's instinctive. And so too, if you criticize me, not only am I not going to say, oh, you're right, I didn't think of it that way, I'm going to fight back directly at you. And this is human nature, and the power of criticism is amazingly potent. I don't do anything wrong, and when you tell me I do, not only don't I accept it, I fight back like a bear. And I used to tell the guys in my shir that I have three rules for criticism. If you want to know how to be a more effective human being in any relationship, obey these three rules and you'll do much better. Rule number one about criticism is don't do it. Rule number two about criticism is don't do it. And rule number three is don't do it. Don't do it because it gets people upset. Don't do it because it distances people. And don't do it because it doesn't do any good. No one ever said, oh, I didn't realize that. Oh, I'm a criminal. Got it. I'm going to change my ways. I'm going to give up stealing. And I'm now going to find another path in life. And as people don't change on major issues because they were criticized, they don't change on minor issues as well. And here is one of the greatest observations. The more important you are in my eyes, the more damaging and destructive the criticism is. You see, if I look at you as not significant, not important, so a little fly came and you know, bothered me, shepherded me. So what? Doesn't bother me. But imagine for a minute that I look at you as someone important, someone central, someone very significant in my world, and you're standing there telling me that I'm no good. You see, while you may have criticized the behavior, while the words that you may have said focused on the action, what I hear much louder than that is the message that I, as a human being, am no good. I, as a person, am a failure. And even if you're just telling me that I'm sloppy or late, or that I missed a point on a test, the words that I hear and the message that I hear are very different. The words might be X, Y, and Z. The message cuts to the core of me, and I cannot accept those words because I can't accept that message that I'm no good, and I will fight against it. I will rebel against it. And the bigger you are in my eyes, the more damaging those words are, and the more I will fight against it. And I believe that this is the answer for Yaakov Avinu. There was probably no one in the world bigger to Reuven than his father Yaakov. This was his Rebbe. This was his link to Sinai. This was his teacher, the man who he emulated, the man who he studied, the man who he loved, but the man who he looked up to as everything great. And if Yaakov Avinu would have said the words, "What you've done is wrong," and given tochacha, Yaakov was afraid that those words would have been like a wedge, a powerful wedge pushing him away, because how could I live with that? The man who I so respect, the man who I so look up to, said to me the words that I am wrong, I am bad, I am no good. And even though the words might have only been about this particular issue, about moving around the beddings, the message would have been that I failed. And that is such an uncomfortable sensation for a human. And the greatness within the human screams out, it can't be. And he would have accepted and adopted some sort of philosophy, some sort of other way of thinking to make himself feel better about it. And Yaakov Avinu was afraid that Reuven, as great as he was, would have been Dovek, but Esav would have gone to Esav. And I believe this concept is fundamental to any relationship that you will ever have on the planet. As a teacher, as a parent, as a co-worker, as a boss, it affects everything. The simple understanding that human beings hate criticism. They hate it like a plague. They avoid it like a plague. And when you criticize someone, what you're doing is you're sending them away. The message that you're sending to them is, I disapprove of you. Even if the words sound innocuous, even if the words are, your shoes aren't tied properly, those are the words. But the message comes way, way louder than the words. The message is, I disapprove of you. You have failed. And that message is something that we human beings don't deal well with. And if you'd like to be a more effective person in any relationship in life, don't criticize. Don't be a critic. Stop yourself from doing it. And while that may be true for any relationship, it is a kal vachomer, benosho kal vachomer, it is so much more exponentially significant when it comes to a marriage. Chazal gave us a very simple formula. The formula for a successful, beautiful, happy marriage could not be more simple. If he honors her more than he honors himself, if he loves her like himself, if she honors him exceedingly, they will have a beautiful marriage. And it's so simple, so obvious, and yet so difficult. And one of the greatest, most disastrous things that husbands and wife do is that they criticize. They notice every flaw, they point it out, and they make sure that he or she realizes exactly what it is that they've done wrong. Listen, I'm a fair person. I'll compliment her when she does right, but if she messes up, I'll let her know. And whether it be that she's late, or she burnt the kugel, or she doesn't look so good, or whatever. Listen, you want me to lie? You want me to just let her live in a delusion world? She needs to know the truth, so I let her know. And husbands, on a regular basis, make sure that their wife knows exactly what they've done wrong. And by the way, not maliciously, not intending to do harm. Listen, she just doesn't look so good today. Or it happens to be that dish doesn't really tastes so good. I believe it's true now, and it's surely true earlier in my marriage. My wife stopped asking me whether the food tastes good or not. She won't ask me because she knows she's not going to get a true answer. And the kids joke about it. And she'll ask the kids, but not me. Why? Because I'm not foolish enough to say those words. I wish it were because I was tzaddik, but it's much more because I understand that saying that the dish didn't come out so good has a certain effect. Now they say to me, come on, she's asking, and she wants to know. And she's a mature woman, and she's not going to fall apart because she burnt the potato kugel, right? But those words, within the context of a marriage, are the exact opposite message of what a husband should be giving to his wife. What a woman needs to know is that she's cherished, that she's loved, that she's approved of. And when a woman knows that she's number one, and if a woman ever thought that in her husband's eyes she's infallible, it would go worlds and worlds to making her happy in that marriage. And when a woman hears the opposite, and even if it's something not such a big deal, she messed up in some area or said something foolish or made a mistake or disciplined the children the wrong way, the words that you didn't do something right are tiny compared to the message that I disapprove of what you did, I disapprove of you. And criticism does not have to be major tochacha. Criticism doesn't have to be you failed the biggest test in life. Criticism comes in so many different forms and packages, and it comes in big forms and little forms, comes in little issues and big. And if you'd like to destroy your marriage, make sure that you find everything that your wife does wrong and point it out to her. Because while the words are small, the message that she hears are messages of disapproval, condemnation, and the opposite of what she needs. And you'll say, but it's not what I meant. And you're right, but it's what she heard. And obviously, the same carries through for women as well. If the Rambam's formula is to honor your husband exceedingly, well, guess what? When you make it a point to let him know that you notice every time he's whatever it may be, whether it's late or sloppy or too stingy or too whatever, because every marriage has its own unique complexion. When you make it a point to let him know the problems that he has, well, guess what? He doesn't hear that he's competent, that he's put together, that his wife respects him. What he hears are the words, you don't really have it together, guy. You're not really good enough. You're not really there. And not meaning to, each spouse plays a huge problem in the attacks on one another in the most innocent sounding way. No one means it as an attack. No one comes home and says, I'm going to stab my wife right in the heart. I'm going to just destroy her. But when you notice those things, point them out to her. And even if it's for her good, what you're doing is sending a huge and powerful message. I don't approve of you. I don't accept you. And those words are powerful, powerful words. She's not going to feel good about them. She's not going to be happy with herself about them. And she's not going to accept them. And if you'll say to me, but come on, this is not, how could you not criticize when you're living in such close proximity and you're doing everything together and you notice that he did this wrong and she does it? How could you not comment? How could you not? It's just natural. How could you not do it? So if you sincerely believe that, I'd like to ask you a very simple question. Are you allowed to eat a cheeseburger if you're hungry? Right? Let's imagine for a minute you haven't eaten in a whole day and you're very, very hungry. You're really very, very hungry. And you're passing McDonald's. Are you allowed to go in? Because listen, Torah forbids you to eat basar chalav normally, but this is a different circumstance because you're hungry. I would like to propose that you're not allowed to eat that cheeseburger if you're hungry, and even if you're kind of hungry. Well, what about if you're really, really, really hungry? What if you haven't eaten in 24 hours and you're so hungry, you're drooling, and I can barely hold back. Then are you allowed to eat the cheeseburger? I'd like to share with you that even then, you're not allowed to eat the cheeseburger. Even if you're so hungry, even if you're famished, even if you're so, so hungry, unless it's literally a situation of pikuach nefesh, you're not allowed to eat trei food, even if you want to, even if you desire it, even if it's hard for you to resist. Well, I'd like to share with you that criticism is exactly in that category. Criticism is destructive to a marriage. It's destructive to all human relations. It's destructive as a parent to a child, but especially in this relationship called marriage, it is one of the most potent destructive forces, and we do it all the time without even recognizing the damage. And you'll say to me, so I should just let everything go? I should just not even comment? So the answer to that is there are things that you as a spouse need in a marriage, and there are things that you should communicate to your spouse. But criticism isn't a form of communication. Criticism is a form of putting a wedge between you and your spouse. Criticism is a way of shooting a barb directly into the heart of the person who's supposed to be closest to you. If you have an issue, if you feel that there isn't enough, whatever it may be, you use a system called communication. And the rules are very simple. There are three of them. I, not you. When you say it and how you say it. What you say is, I need, I feel. When you say it is not b'shas mais, and not when the heat of the moment, it's at a different time when things are settled, excuse me, and what you say, first you give five compliments, you explain how valuable your husband is in your eyes, how much it means to you that he's always there, always watching out for you and the kids, but I need this. I feel it'd be better this. And those words are communicating a legitimate need. And how many are you allowed? One issue. One issue. You want him to be on time. You want him to be more attentive. You want him to take you out more often. Whatever the issue may be, one issue, and you communicate it. And then at a certain point, you recognize that you've done your job. Your husband gets it. He understands that it's very important to you. And I'd like to share with you that if you repeat those words 10,000 times, he's not going to understand it better. On the 10,000th time that you've told him whatever it may be, he doesn't now get it better than when you told him 9,999 times. The only difference is that he's much less motivated to do that which we human beings have a tough time doing called changing. You see, there is a reality that each spouse has to recognize, and that is that a big part of a successful marriage is understanding that my spouse isn't perfect, everything that I wish for isn't going to be, at least not right now, and change takes a long time. So if it's his job to change, if it's his job to stop doing whatever it's he's doing, it's your job to gently, politely communicate it to him, that it hurts you, that it bothers you, and then to stop. And oftentimes, a woman and a husband have a choice in a marriage. They'll find something that a spouse is doing that really is annoying or bothersome or whatever it may be. And they know it, and their spouse knows it. And now they have a choice. They either learn to put up with it, they have a successful, beautiful marriage with a chasaron, an issue that my spouse doesn't do as I wish, or they can choose to live in misery. Because I guarantee when you tell your husband the 10,000th time that he left his socks on the floor, or he doesn't do whatever, or if you tell your wife those words, I guarantee they don't hear it better, but all that happens is you destroy the fabric of your marriage. Because women don't take it well, men don't take it well, human beings don't take it well. This thing called complaining and carping and criticizing is destructive. And there will be many, many times when you will have to do exactly that. You'll have to say the words, guess what? I have to be quiet. But how can I not let him know? How can I not teach him? How can I not help him? Well, you're not helping him and you're not teaching him anyway, because that's not the way you do it. He knows it already. He understands it already. Your choice is, do you blurt out, say the words that are bothering you and damage your marriage, or do you learn to be quiet? And this cuts across both sides of the gender. Meaning to say, husbands have to learn to be ever so guarded. Your wife's heart is a sensitive, sensitive part. And she's looking to you for approval. She wants acceptance. She wants to feel cherished. And when you use words of criticism, large or small, you're hurting her. And when she reacts, guess what? Who brought it upon? Well, she did it. She, come on, look what she did. Look what she did. It's true, I guess. But when you shot those arrows right into our heart, well, guess what? And one of the most ironic, one of the most interesting things about human relations is that I'm never wrong. Do you ever see a couple come into a marriage therapist or into a Rav's office and say the words, you know, Rabbi, we both agree, we both feel that he's completely at fault in this marriage. Yep, we both agree. No, Rabbi, we both agree that she's totally the problem. I've never seen it. I've heard finger pointing and blaming and blaming and blaming. And if you ever watched two cats fight, two tomcats in a battle, watch a couple when things are beginning to spin out of control. It's his fault, it's her fault. And you can never trace it back. But I understand, somebody's got to be wrong. Somebody's got to be the one who started it, right? And the answer is neither one started it and neither one is at fault. Both have a part of it. And there's only one thing to do if you'd like to have a successful marriage. You have to figure out where it starts and not engage in it. And oftentimes, where it starts is a simple thing called being critical, the simple thing of letting my spouse know that I disapprove. But shouldn't I let her know it? Doesn't she have to know it? So I have a very simple question to ask you. Is it effective? Have you found that when you let her know that the house is a mess and it bothers you, have you found the house to be more neat or less neat? Have you found it to be a motivating force or a demotive? Well, come on, I have to be honest. I can't lie to her. We can't have a relationship with this based on checker. I guess you're right if you don't want to be in a happy marriage. And you can find many successful marriages, beautiful, flourishing marriages, where he does something that bothers her acutely. Or she does something that bothers him in a very real way. And I'd like to share with you that most successful marriages have that. If you find me a person who's deeply, passionately in love after 20 years or 30 years of marriage, ask them this question. Does everything that your spouse do please you? Oh, yes. Everything, she's perfect. She's like a Malach HaSharis. She walks on water. It's just unbelievable. I doubt that you'll find a human being who speaks that way. Because I doubt that there's a human being who has a marriage that functions that way. So here's the question. How could it be that you could have long-standing marriages where both parties are very happy, very much in love, and they have a beautiful marriage that they both gain tremendously from, and yet there's a clear flaw in their spouse, and they know it? How could it be? Don't they tell them about it? Don't they point it out to them? Don't they mention it? Don't they repeat it? Don't they destroy their marriage time after time after time? And the answer is eventually people begin to realize it doesn't help. It doesn't change the behavior, and it's my choice. I either own up to the fact that it's not going to change, I embrace it, I accept it. My partner in life has a flaw. Could be I have one or two myself, but my partner in life has something that she does that doesn't completely please me, and I don't mention it, I don't notice it. I may notice it, but I don't let her know about it, and I build my marriage. Or, as is awfully common, I make sure that she's fully aware of how much it bothers me, when it bothers me, as it bothers me, and I constantly point it out to her so that eventually she'll learn, eventually she'll change, she'll get the message that she has to stop doing what she's doing. And what I do is I don't change her, but I destroy my marriage. And many, many a times, a husband and a wife, both are guilty of this. And if you'd like to have a beautiful, successful marriage, learn this one yesod of human relations. Don't criticize. Don't mention it. Don't notice it. And even if it's in body language, even if it's just a nose pointing up or a roll of the eyes, don't let your spouse know that you disapprove of what he or she is doing. But you do this, but that's me. You can't expect me to just change who I am, right? Much like we can't expect you to stop eating cheeseburgers if you like cheeseburgers, or much like we can't expect you to change. But no one understands that you are a huge participant in the destruction of your marriage. Would you like a muscle, what it's like to live with a critical person? Imagine that there is a family of porcupines. You know, porcupines, it's that little animal with 30,000 quills that are sharp barbs. And of course, when you attack a porcupine, what it does is it shoots out those arrows and it enters the flesh because they're pointy as needles and they penetrate. Well, imagine you have a family of porcupines and it's a bitter cold winter. And since it's such a bitter cold winter and they have no source of heat, what they do is they huddle up in their cave and they get as close as they can to one another so they could share each other's body warmth. But the only problem is, as they get close, the needles of each other prick and penetrate the skin. And as the porcupines get closer and closer, yes, it's warm, but jab and jab and jab. That's what it's like living with a critical person. 30,000 of those needles penetrating on a daily basis. And if you were married to a tzaddik, if you were married to the greatest woman in the generation, she might be able to take it, but you and I aren't. And the reality is that if you're going to be critical, you're going to pay the price. The price is you're going to get it back. Exactly what the Orach HaTzaddikim describes. If I were to punch you, it'd be obvious you're going to punch me back. That's human nature. If I'm going to criticize you, it's going to come back to me. And I believe what this Chazal teaches us is that it's not just human nature. The greater you are, the more you're going to have this issue. Reuven was one of the Shvatim, one of the greatest human beings who probably ever lived. And it would have forced him so far. Yaakov Avinu was afraid his whole life to say the words of rebuke because he was afraid that his son, his beloved son, his most dear son would leave him. Because the bigger you are to that person, the more those words penetrate. The words are less than the message. The message is, I disapprove of you. You did something wrong. You are incomplete. And we human beings don't deal well with that. There's a part within me that wells up and says, no, I can't accept that. There's a greatness within the human heart that demands accomplishing, being noble and great. And when you stand over me and point out my flaws, not only don't I accept them, I fight against them. I don't accept your words. I don't hear your words. No human being ever does anything wrong. And we human beings don't accept criticism very well. And if you'd like to succeed in your marriage, don't do it. And I have one more mushel that I want to share with you because it's so critical to understanding how fights start. And it's usually so subtle, and it's usually beyond anyone's understanding. When I was a little boy, I remember going into my mother, Allah Shalom's bedroom, and she had a dresser. And on top of the dresser, on one wall, was a mirror, a nice big mirror. And on the other wall, opposite the dresser, was also a large mirror. And I remember as a little boy looking into the mirror on her dresser, and because that mirror opposed was facing the mirror on the wall, I saw me in the mirror on the dresser, and I saw a reflection of me in the mirror behind the dresser. And then that reflection reflected back into the one of the dresser, and that reflection reflected back, and back and forth, and back and forth. There weren't one of me, there weren't 10 of me, there were hundreds of me. And I remember constantly looking, I want to find the last me. I want to find the last me. And I can never find it because the reflection reflected back and back and back and back and back and back. And there was never an end to it. When a fight starts in a marriage, that's what happens. It's one simple indiscretion. But those words are spoken by someone so close. Those words are spoken by someone who I'm so vulnerable to, who I look to, who I take as my closest friend and confidant. And those words penetrate deeply, and it's human nature to dish it back. Well, if I was a big tzaddik, I would maybe. But I don't know many people in our generation who are that great. And because I dish it back, well, guess what? She hears words of criticism, damaging words, and guess what? She also has a human heart. And what she does is she responds in kind, then I respond, then she responds, and I respond, and it never ends. And one of the greatest things you can do if you want to succeed in marriage is train your tongue to only notice good things, compliment, Make sure that your words are powerful and positive, and make sure that you don't criticize. There are no two marriages that are the same. And one of the great wonders of creation is the fact that Hashem created one world, one man, and every human being is so vastly different. The Mishnah in Sanhedrin tells us that this is one of the wonders of creation. When a human being creates a mint and stamps out coins, every coin is identical. The first one as the 10th, as the 100th, as the millionth. Because it's a mint that stamps out one after another, after another, after another, identical, the same as the first. When Hashem created man, Hashem created man with an ability to have another human being. And that second human being is not doma, is not similar to the first. And each human being is unique. Each human being has a different face. Each human being has a different fingerprint. Each human being has a different voice. And Reuven is about as different from Shimon as night is to day. And you could say Edus. You can be a witness of the fact that it was Reuven who did that act because I saw him. Or even I recognize his voice. Because Shimon and Levi are not the same. And Chazal tell us, as our facial appearances are never the same one to another, so too our minds are not the same. The reason why there's always differences of opinion, the reason why there are always conservatives and liberals and radicals, and the reason why even in learning there's such differences is because each human mind is different, and because my mind is different than your mind, I perceive things differently. I view it differently. I look at the world from a different vantage point. And as no two human beings are the same, no two marriages are ever the same. Take two unique human beings, each one different than any other person on the planet. Mix them up into different homes with different upbringings, with different personalities. Make sure that they're even more different because they're on opposite sides of the gender, where they're literally opposite one the other. Well, guess what? When you mix these two together, you're going to have a unique combination. And for that reason, no two marriages are the same. As no two human beings are the same, no two marriages are the same. And a marriage is the most complex mix of personality and temperament, and it is a very, very great chemistry. And if you'd like to try one day to see how wise you are, try to create two human beings to meet together properly and appropriately. And I believe with even a minor amount of humility, you realize it's impossible. Hashem is the one who's mezaveg zivugim. Hashem is the one who matches together perfectly the husband and the wife and puts them into the world to be together. And if you'd like to know why it is that today there's such a high divorce rate when there never was before, it's not because Hashem has gotten sloppy, chas v'shalom, at the game. It's Hashem is just as good as Kaviyachov could be, as Hashem always was. But the difference is that we have lost a lot of the understanding of what it means to be married and how it a husband and a wife together need to work. There's one more point that I want to add, and this will be the summation, almost the end of what we're doing. I created this seminar because I was so troubled by marriages that had spun out of control. There had never been such things. Everyone has issues. All marriages have points. But what I was coming across on a regular basis are so many young people and not so young people who had marriages that were so out of sorts that they were no longer functional. The steps that I outlaid here took a lot of time. I believe that there's much wisdom because it came from Chazal. It also came from many secular sources. And I read extensively, met with various marriage therapists and people in Rabbanim who are in the field. And I have some exposure. It is not the end-all and be-all to all marriage seminars, and is tremendous amount more wisdom and concepts and work that needs to be done. A marriage is an ongoing process of growth, of accomplishing, of drawing ever closer, learning what to stop doing, and learn to do what you need to do. And there often comes a certain point where you need help. If you find that you're at a point where things aren't improving, or you're stuck and it's not just not going, that doesn't mean you married the wrong one. And it doesn't mean that this is the way it has to be. It means you have to change. But oftentimes change isn't simple because it's not just changing you, it's changing your spouse. And for that reason, oftentimes you need an outside source. If you find you're at that point, I highly recommend you find a person to help you. You need a person with wisdom, a person with understanding. It's best if it's a Rav who deals with these type of things, if not to do the actual marriage therapy, at least to put you in the right direction, put you on the path. And many, many times, a marriage that's spinning out of control can be changed, can be corrected, often with outside intervention, but it changes dramatically. What I'd like to do now is sum up the entire series, the entire seminar, in a very quick way. The first and primary thing that a husband and wife have to know is that love is the glue of their marriage. The courtship has to continue. They have to continue nurturing. They have to continue being there for each other. They have to spend time as a couple. They have to go out. They have to talk. They have to be together as a couple. Because if that romantic edge, that romantic piece falls apart, it's going to be a very, very difficult thing. There are other pieces of it. You have to spend a lot of time speaking. You have to spend a lot of time, as the Chazon Ish tells us, that communication is essential. It's more natural to a woman than it is to a man, but both have to participate. There are roles of physical intimacy. There are roles of being together. Those on the positive side, you have to understand how they function, and you have to use the system. And you also have to avoid the negative. There are love busters. There are things that literally take the air out of the balloon. You blow the balloon up, you blow it, but you put a pin in it and it lets the air out. Selfish demands, annoying habits, angry outbursts, they will destroy a marriage. And while you understand that you have to change those things that bother your spouse, as a spouse on the receiving end, you also have to understand that there will be things that will happen in your marriage that will displease you, that will annoy you, and it's unlikely that your spouse is going to change them anytime soon. And what you have to do is make a decision. I embrace him or her as they are, or I live in misery. If I cannot accept, I cannot tolerate a person who is, and just put out the laundry list, whatever it may be, and I will make sure that he or she knows it, make sure that you are prepared for the consequences, which is misery, pain, and suffering. And if you'd like to be successfully married, a big part of that is recognizing that as I have flaws, and even though they don't bother me, they bother my spouse, so too my spouse has flaws, I can communicate, and I can let him or her know, and at a certain point I have to recognize that that's part of the game, and I make a choice. I accept it, or I suffer. And at the same time, you have to recognize that there are vast differences between you and your spouse. Men are from Mars, and women are from Venus. That means as a husband, you have to validate your wife. You have to listen to her. You have to pay careful attention to her emotions. She's not criticizing you. When she's complaining and when she's venting, she's not blaming you for the fact that her boss is too tough or the situation is rough. And it's not a condemnation of you. She's trying to share. And as a wife, you have to recognize that your husband doesn't need fixing. And if he does, you sure better not be the one to do it because you're going to suffer. And what each has to learn is that they're different. And not to be dismissive, not to assume that I know the right way and all girls are that way. Oh boy, that's just guys. But rather to train your tongue to say the words, that's strange. Why did my wife react that way? Why did my husband act that way? And if you train your tongue to say those words, you don't fall prey to what so many of us do. Our husband or our wife does something and we become extraordinarily judgmental. Oh, that's what he is. That's what she is. She's just a... And you'll find that spouses have versions, pictures of their spouse that no other human being shares. And a wife will describe her husband as the worst sort of creep you've ever seen, and no one else sees him that way. But how could it be? Oh, she must see the real him? No, she doesn't see the real him. What she sees is a version of him that she's allowed herself to accept because she accepted that version and then expected it, and then he reacted, then she reacted, and before you know it, they're each living up to their expectations. And at the same time, you have to learn to be appreciative of your spouse. You have to recognize all that he or she does. Is it natural? No, it takes training. If I ask you the question, are you rich? No one's rich. Do you have blessings in your life? No one has blessings. And as we have to train ourselves to recognize the wealth of our generation, We have to train ourselves to recognize the wonder of having eyes and ears, having mobility and having the gifts that Hashem gave us. You also have to train yourself to recognize the advantages, the milas of your spouse. That Baruch Hashem, Hashem gave you the right person, but he's not perfect. That's right, neither are you. But he meets your needs, and you meet his needs, and this is the one that Hashem gave you, and you have to train yourself to see his milas, not to see the flaws which are so natural. And probably more than anything, you have to understand the relationship of a marriage. The relationship of a marriage is that you are best friends forever. Friends act as friends act. Reim ahuvim, friends who love one another, act as friends. Friends are tolerant. Friends are accepting. Friends overlook flaws. Friends enjoy life together. You're friends. No one is the boss. Friends don't boss friends around. Friends don't criticize friends. Friends don't act as intolerant, mean people. And that relationship requires protecting. It's going to have moments. Your marriage, unless you're an unique individual, you're going to have a lot of pain in your marriage. It's a shame you'll have a lot of beautiful times together, but you will fight. There'll be things that he says or she says that end up spinning out of control, and you're going to look at each other and say, how did we end up here? But you're going to be hurt and angry, and you're going to want vengeance. This is the person who I love. This is the person who's so close to me. This is the person who I've given up everything for, and this is how they act. And in your heart is going to be a desire for vengeance, to revenge, to get back, to get even. And that's one of the great challenges of life. Marriage isn't easy. Hashem gave us this laboratory called growth, gave us many opportunities to be challenged, and one of the great nishonos of life is to be successfully married. And many, many times it requires changing, growing. Many times it requires not saying something. Many times it requires overlooking. And many times it requires saying the words, I was wrong. I'm sorry. But she should apply. No, he should. No, she should. No. Yep, and that's the game. Hashem made for you a match in heaven, and it is the most beautiful relationship in existence. When a husband and wife are together, it's beautiful, it's enriching, it's empowering, each one cherishing one the other, each one there for the other. It is the closest relationship, it is the most beautiful relationship, but it takes work. It takes work, and it takes change. May Hashem grant you only nachas, mazel, and bracha. May you find, from now on, tremendous siyata shmaya. When you're finding trouble, you have to know when to ask. You have to know who to ask and when to ask. And you have to daven. But when you do that, Hashem helps. And you have a beautiful, successful marriage. May you have only mazel and hatzlacha in everything you do.